The dream thoughts berate him as a simpleton. We have drawn our first proof for the existence of the censor from this example of the inversion of emotions. Nor is it necessary here to assume that the dream activity creates a counter-emotion of this kind out of nothing. It usually finds it lying ready in the material of the dream thoughts, and intensifies it solely with the psychic force of the resisting impulse until a point is reached where the emotion can be won over for the formation of the dream. In the dream of my uncle just mentioned, the affectionate counter-emotion has probably originated from an infantile source, as the continuation of the dream would suggest, for the relation between uncle and nephew has become the source of all my friendships and hatreds, owing to the peculiar nature of my childish experiences. There is a class of dreams deserving the designation hypocritical, which puts the theory of wish fulfillment to a severe test. My attention was called to them when Mrs. Dr. M. Hilferding brought up for discussion in the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society the dream reported by Rosiger, which is reprinted below. In Waldheimat, Volume 11, Rosiger writes as follows in his story Fremdgemacht, page 303. I have usually enjoyed healthful sleep, but I have lost the rest of many a night. With my modest existence as a student and literary man, I have for long years dragged along with me the shadow of a veritable tailor's life, like a ghost from which I could not become separated. I cannot say that I have occupied myself so often and so vividly with thoughts of my past during the day. An assailer of heaven and earth arising from the skin of the Philistine has other things to think about. Nor did I, as a dashing young fellow, think about my nocturnal dreams. Only later, when I got into the habit of thinking about everything, or when the Philistine within me again asserted itself, it struck me that whenever I dreamed I was always the journeyman tailor, and was always working in my master's shop for long hours without any remuneration. As I sat there and sewed and pressed, I was quite aware that I no longer belonged there, and that as a burgess of a town I had other things to attend to. But I was forever having vacations and going out into the country, and it was then that I sat near my boss and assisted him. I often felt badly, and regretted the loss of time which I might spend for better and more useful purposes. If something did not come up to the measure and cut exactly, I had to submit to a reproach from the boss. Often, as I sat with my back bent in the dingy shop, I decided to give notice that I was going to quit. On one occasion I actually did so, but the boss took no notice of it, and the next time I was again sitting near him and sewing. How happy I was when I woke up after such weary hours! And I then resolved that, if this dream came intruding again, I would throw it off with energy and would cry aloud, "It is only a delusion, I am in bed, and I want to sleep." And the next night I would be sitting in the tailor shop again. Thus years passed with dismal regularity. While the boss and I were working at Appelhofer's, at the house of the peasant where I began my apprenticeship, it happened that he was particularly dissatisfied with my work. "I should like to know where in the world your thoughts are," cried he, and looked at me gloomily. I thought the most sensible thing for me to do would be to get up and explain to the boss that I was with him only as a favour, and then leave. But I did not do this. I submitted, however, when the boss engaged an apprentice and ordered me to make room for him on the bench. I moved into the corner, and kept on sewing. On the same day another tailor was engaged. He was bigoted, as he was a Czech who had worked for us 19 years before, and then had fallen into the lake on his way home from the public house. When he tried to sit down, there was no room for him. I looked at the boss inquiringly, and he said to me, "You have no talent for the tailoring business. You may go. You are free." My fright on that occasion was so overpowering that I awoke. The morning grey glimmered through the clear window of my beloved home. Objects of art surrounded me. In the tasteful bookcase stood the eternal Homer, the gigantic Dante, the incomparable Shakespeare, the glorious Goethe, all shining and immortal. From the adjoining room resounded the clear little voices of the children, who were waking and prattling with their mother. I felt as if I had found again that idyllically sweet, that peaceful, poetical, and spiritual life which I have so often and so deeply conceived as the contemplative fortune of mankind. And still I was vexed that I had not given my boss notice first, instead of allowing him to discharge me. And how remarkable it is, after the night when the boss discharged me, I enjoyed rest. I no longer dreamed of my tailoring, of this experience which lay in the remote past, which in its simplicity was really happy, and which, nevertheless, threw a long shadow over the later years of my life. 1. In this dream, the series of the poet who in his younger years has been a journeyman tailor, it is hard to recognize the domination of the wish fulfillment. All the delightful things occur during the waking state, while the dream seemed to drag along the ghost-like shadow of an unhappy existence which had been long forgotten. My own dreams of a similar nature have put me in a position to give some explanation for such dreams. As a young doctor, I for a long time worked in the Chemical Institute without being able to accomplish anything in that exacting science, and I therefore never think in my waking state about this unfruitful episode in my life of which I am really ashamed. On the other hand, it has become a recurring dream with me that I am working in the laboratory, making analyses, and having experiences there, etc. Like the examination dreams, these dreams are disagreeable, and they are never very distinct. During the analysis of one of these dreams, my attention was directed to the word analysis, which gave me the key to an understanding of these dreams. For I had since become an analyst. I make analyses which are highly praised, to be sure, psychoanalyses. I then understood that when I grew proud of these analyses of the waking state and wanted to boast how much I had accomplished thereby, the dream would hold up to me at night those other unsuccessful analyses of which I had no reason to be proud. They are the punitive dreams of the upstart, like those of the tailor who became a celebrated poet. But how is it possible for the dream to place itself at the service of self-criticism in its conflict with parvenu pride, and to take as its content a rational warning instead of the fulfillment of a prohibitive wish? I have already mentioned that the answer to this question entails many difficulties. We may conclude that the foundation of the dream was at first formed by a fantasy of overweening ambition, but that only its suppression and its abashment reached the dream content in its stead. One should remember that there are masochistic tendencies in the psychic life to which such an inversion might be attributed. But a more thorough investigation of the individual dreams allows the recognition of still another element. In an indistinct, subordinate portion of one of my laboratory dreams, I was just at the age which placed me in the most gloomy and most unsuccessful year of my professional career.